You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Andrea Barrett's collection of stories, Ship Fever, was published in 1996, critics were awed by the way she was able to intersect science and personal relationships, and she was given a National Book Award. Now, in The Air We Breathe, Ms. Barrett's first book in over 5 years, we meet some of the characters from those stories once again, this time in a public tuberculosis sanatorium on the eve of World War I. The novel is published by Norton, and I'm very pleased that it brings Andrea Barrett back to the show today. Always a pleasure to see you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Was it your plan from the beginning to write a novel with characters from Ship Fever?
It wasn't. These characters that I've linked together through the books, I never meant to link any of them. It's something that grew really organically. As I started each piece, I would realize that there were overlaps in the setting, in the time, that I might be able to move a character from one book over into the next story or move a descendant of that character.
Well, when you finish a book, because you don't tie everything up, do you think sometimes afterward, gee, I wonder what happened to so-and-so?
I think always what happened to so-and-so. When I finish a book or a story, there's something in terms of the shape that says this story is done, this novel is done, but the characters are still very alive for me after the story closes or the novel closes, and I think of their lives as just going on without me someplace so that I can go back to them and just open the door on their lives and say, hey, what are you doing now?
You've included a chart of familial relationships at the end of the book. Not at the beginning, as we used to get in Russian novels. if you put it in the front, would you have ruined some of the plot surprises?
I think I would. The chart that's in the back now is strange for two reasons. One is that it includes a lot of people who are not in this book, and that speaks to people who've read the earlier books and are curious about how the characters link together.
Faulkner could have done something like that.
He did in some ways, and in the same way that Faulkner did. If you study this chart closely, it actually functions as an epilogue to the book. It reveals the outcome of several relationships that don't round off within the confines of the novel.
So does that mean you may return to some of these characters and explore those relationships now that you've kind of worked them out for yourself?
Yeah, I've actually started writing a story about one of the characters after she walks off stage in this novel. I knew that I couldn't explore her story in the confines of this book, and I'm so interested in her, I couldn't put her down. So,
many people are familiar with cure houses for the wealthy, such as the one that your character, Miles Fairchild, stays in. But they're probably less likely to have heard of institutions like Tamarack State, which was for the poor. Now, you've invented this place, but is it based on a real place?
It's based on a number of real places, but the one that's in there most strongly is a place called Raybrook, which was a public sanatorium up outside Saranac Lake. It's between Saranac Lake and Lake Placid. It's a men's prison now.
Now, why would those places be used for sanatoria? Thomas Mann sets his sanatorium on the top of a mountain, mm-hmm. where we assume the air will be pure. Do people think air was pure at Saranac Lake?
They did. They marketed the air there as being uniquely healthful because it's so saturated with piney smells and sprucey smells, and it's a long way from a big city. For a long time, people seemed to think that being up a few thousand feet and being among the trees would somehow produce a quality in the air that might disinfect your lungs. So you find sanatoria in Colorado and North Carolina and the mountains of California and the mountains of upstate New York.
And that's why the title, The Air We Breathe.
Very much.
Because they were hoping for pure air. But what got you writing about these public sanatoria? How did you even learn about them?
I learned about them really towards the end of my last book. I wrote a story called The Cure and Servants of the Map, which is about women running boarding cottages for wealthier patients. And as I was doing the research for that, learning about the 1880s and 1890s, I became aware of these large public sanatoria outside the villages. They're very forbidding. The architecture is very prison-like. And people were sent there almost always from the city, most particularly from this city, and sent not always by their own choice, so that even before they became prisons, they had a kind of prison-like quality to them.
Because they were kind of expected to stay within the confines.
Yeah, they really had to. So there was an element of not having a choice. It's always very interesting for a novelist, a group of people thrown together not by affinity but by coercion, in a sense.
Were they funded by taxpayers' dollars?
They were. That was state money, in some cases municipal money. It varied.
What was the prescribed treatment in 1916 for consumption, as tuberculosis was called then?
You were supposed to lie outside in the freezing cold air as many hours a day as possible, up to 16. You were supposed to eat 5 meals a day. You were not supposed to move or talk much or wave your arms about. You were not supposed to have a huge amount of intellectual activity, because most people with tuberculosis have a fever, and mental excitement was thought to stimulate fever. Not a concept we're as familiar with now. So it was really rest, good food, quiet brain. And for many people, the thing that probably worked best was simply the fact that they weren't working. A lot of the people in these institutions were working 12, 16 hours a day, 6 days a week. That's a hard way to keep your immune system in shape to fight off anything.
Well, they had probably contracted tuberculosis because of the close confines of the factories that they worked in, or the tenements that they lived in.
That's
but weren't
right.
they in close confines here as well?
They were in close confines. They often had roommates in their rooms, and when they were out on the porches, they were near each other. But this is where the air comes in. Even if you were lying next to each other on a porch, it was thought that these great gusts of piney, scented, cold air would somehow sweep the germs away.
Did it work?
It worked for some people whose immune systems were functioning well anyway. If you take someone who's working very hard and eating bad food and sleeping in great crowds and not in a ventilated place, and you move them and you let them rest, their own body's defenses may push off the disease, and that did work for some people.
My guest is Andrea Barrett, whose latest book is a novel called The Air We Breathe. It's from W.W. Norton. And writers often talk about having problems finding a voice. When mm-hmm. Once they find the voice, then the book becomes a lot easier. This is one of the oddest voices I've ever encountered. You've told the story in the past tense from the point of view of a collective we, the patients at the sanitarium. This is a variant on first person. How did you come up with it?
You know, it really is an odd voice, and I wish I had come up with it, but in fact, it announced itself to me. The book always came to me in this voice, and it was hard to write because of the voice. Sometimes I would get discouraged and try and make it a singular narrator or a group of limited third-person narrators, but it always reverted to this. And I think that's because in the end, the voice comes to actually embody what's really important in the book, so that it's not just telling you about the events. The tension in the voice between the singular and the collective is the tension in the novel.
Can you read a little excerpt that gives us an idea of how that voice works?
Sure.
My guest is Andrea Barrett, author of the National Book Award winner Ship Fever and any number of other books, the latest, The Air We Breathe.
This is a section from about a third of the way through the novel. Years ago, a man came to Tamarack Lake from New York in the hopes of improving his health, married the undertaker's daughter, worked in a bank, and then built the village's telephone exchange. Resigning his position when he had a relapse, he began in 1912 to write a history of his adopted home. From deeds, contracts, old letters, newspapers, the reminiscences of guides and visitors, he reconstructed who started the bank, built the churches, organized the schools and the hospital. He wrote about when the last guests came to the Northview Inn, when the boathouse fell into the lake, what happened to Dr. Kopechne and the first sanatoria, who donated money to those institutions, and which doctors worked where. Comfortable in his retirement, he sold the exchange at a fine profit, and cared for by his wife, he worked at his project for years, but never mentioned us. Sometimes we sort through those pages, looking for traces of our lives and places where our histories overlap. Fires, accidents, holidays always bring complications, both down in the village and up here. Someone ends up in the infirmary, having grown too melancholy to eat. Someone wanders into the pond and nearly drowns. Friends quarrel savagely.
So it kind of sounds at times like third-person omniscient narrator, but then we realize that we're hearing almost like a chorus telling this story.
Yeah, the best way I've found to describe the voice is that it's actually a plural first-person omniscient narrator, which is so many contradictions in one set of words, you can hardly believe it. But it does have the property, since the facts have been assembled by a group of about 20 patients, and they, since they are speaking as a group and refusing to break down into the singular, of also being omniscient with regard to certain characters, it's getting the information directly from them.
The wealthy patient, Miles Fairchild, gathers the patients at the sanitarium to form a kind of support group that meets every Wednesday to share knowledge and personal histories. Was there such a group?
There were workmen's groups all over this city, and that's where the idea came from.
We now have a publisher called the Workmen's Circle.
We do, and that's actually where that comes from, as far as I know. Workmen's circles in places like the Lower East Side were a really vital part of the community, where people who were working long hours in factories but wanted to stay in touch with the theater, with music, with a whole set of things they were interested in, would meet and teach themselves. So while I'm not aware of one springing up at a sanatorium, I'm very much aware of those as a tradition among those patients, so I just moved it over to there.
There are two young women, Eudora and Naomi, who don't have tuberculosis but work as maids among the sick. What precautions would they have had to take in order to keep from being infected? And were people reluctant to take jobs like that for fear of becoming sick?
People in many places were reluctant to work with patients with tuberculosis. In this particular village, which is based largely on Saranac Lake, there was such an old tradition of caring for the sick and such a history of people who cared for the sick not getting sick that I think workers came to trust that. They knew that if they took relatively elementary precautions, if they washed their hands, if they were not around people who coughed directly on them, if they took some steps to protect themselves. There were generations of people up there who cared for patients and didn't get sick, so that was a really good model for them.
In the house, there's lots of gossip about Leo, Naomi, and Eudora. How frequently did romantic relationships between the patients or the staff occur?
They occurred often enough that relationships among the patients actually had a name. People referred to those as cousins. If you had a girlfriend or a boyfriend, it was called a cousin, and that's in part because many of the patients were married. Their spouses were back in their hometowns or cities. They were separated for years at a time. They tended not to get divorced, but they would form these other bonds with patients, these cousin bonds.
And these people would stay in the sanatoria for years?
Many times years, many years sometimes.
You began your research for the book on September 10th, 2001. Were the attacks at the back of your mind when you were writing the novel?
They were in the year that followed. I came here to do a fellowship at the New York Public Library, and our first official day of work was September 11th, so that was very much what the year became about. It was a great good fortune in some ways to be attached to such a large research institution while this was sweeping over the country. Like everyone else, I was driven to read a great deal about all sorts of things, trying to understand what had happened and trying to make sense of it. And in my case, that took the form of looking back at 1916 and 1917 and looking at the analogies between our country about to enter a war then and our country about to enter a war after the attacks.
Miles Fairchild is heavily involved with a group called the American Protective League. That was a real group, anti-immigrant?
It was very much a real group. It was very powerful. It was extremely strongly anti-German, but it was also pro-patriotic in a larger sense, which meant that you didn't have to be German to cross them. You could fail to buy war bonds in sufficient amount. You could shelter a German or be friends with a German. You could like Beethoven. You didn't have to do very much to cross that group.
The title story from Ship Fever is about a typhus epidemic, and now we have a novel about tubercular patients. Infectious diseases kind of infect you?
Well, they are contagious. They're very interesting to me, obviously, at this point. infectious disease has the property of bringing together science, medicine, public policy, a huge set of emotional issues. It's, again, very interesting for a novelist to sort of poke there because everyone's under pressure during an epidemic or of infectious disease. The patients are involved, the doctors are involved, the policymakers are involved, taxpayers are involved. Everyone's got something to say about this.
Do you see this as a political book on some levels?
I do, actually, which surprised me hugely. I have never been a political writer, and I have not been until recently a particularly political person.
But because of what happened after 9/11, I guess, and
not
other
so much
things
9/11, but the war and the shape the country's taken in the last 4 or 5 years.
This book took you quite a while. Can I assume the next one will come a lot quicker?
I hope so. This one was slow.
The Air We Breathe is Andrea Barrett's latest book, a novel, and it is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.